Lainey Peterson, we're so pleased to have you on the line tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. I know we have just an hour, and I'm going to try and talk fast and squeeze everything I know into an hour. So here we go for the ride. And I guess I'm going to speak for probably about half an hour, and then we'll open it up for more discussions and questions. So just a little bit about my background. As Joe said, I am a psychologist. And fell into story through a back door. I was doing a lot of lecturing on parenting stuff about 15 years ago, and found that I loved to teach and lecture through story, but not because I really knew what I was doing. Just I loved it, and what I found is that I was having more fun with the story part of it than the theory part of it, and it was becoming more of an entertainment hour than an educational hour. So I started to sort of look into more of this story stuff, and it was about that same time that I moved to Massachusetts and first learned about sharing the fire and the lanes and three apples, and all of a sudden I discovered this incredible world of story that I didn't even know existed, and it had been going on for so long without me, I was quick trying to catch up. It wasn't long into that I started learning a little bit about healing story and, of course, was immediately fascinated and wanted to learn more and understand more. I began by doing a lot of reading in the beginning and tried to figure out, what can I do with this? Where can I bring this? But once again, I fell into it a little bit through a back door. And in that way, life has been very kind to me. It was about 12 years ago that a colleague and friend who runs public speaking groups was asked to volunteer her time through a group called City Mission Society in Boston, and they were starting up workshops for recently released prisoners to give them skills to reenter the community, and they thought it would be a really good idea to give them public speaking skills so that they could go into interviews and be able to make eye contact and shake hands and just talk a little bit about where they'd been in a way that prospective job employers and housing people might be able to give them a chance. So my friend Carla accepted this pro bono, but as soon as she did, she felt scared to death and thought, what have I done? And she called me and said, would you be willing just to come in and sort of sit with me in the room? And I said, great, I would love that. And it soon evolved into not just public speaking, but because of my interest, storytelling. And that became one of the real main focuses of the work. And as our first group morphed into a second and a third group, actually Carla left and it became me. And I had the pleasure of working for 7 rounds of recently released prisoners, both men and then women, and then I did co-ed groups as well. And City Mission was very kind in shifting from pro bono into finding grants to support the work and to try and grow the work. And they did grow it. They have since morphed it into a program in Roxbury for the community. The Public Voice Project is open to any citizen of Roxbury who wants to come in and learn how to tell a story and then share their story in an open mic night. And I'm giving you some of this background because some of the stories about what I've learned through this work and some of the things that have happened are going to come to the forefront. More recently, after the Roxbury Public Voice Project, they got a grant to support to bring me into Roxbury Youth Works, where I worked with a small group of young women who were trying to get off the street as prostitutes. And they were hoping that this storytelling program might help them find their voice and find the courage to stand in their shoes in a different way. And that, I think, has been some of my most challenging and exciting work that I've done recently. But as my confidence grew and some of my abilities grew, I started to reach out to other places. I've since then, with my work with City Mission, have gone and worked in homeless shelters and soup kitchens. And more recently, my work has also brought me into hospitals. I've been doing workshops at Dana-Farber for families of children who are struggling with life-threatening cancer, as well as at UMass Medical Center. I've been working with people who are cancer survivors themselves. Most recently, last summer, my daughter, who is in college, had the privilege of going to Cape Town, South Africa for a semester. She got a grant to stay on for the summer and was working at a domestic violence shelter and asked me if I would come join her to work there for 10 days and to run storytelling groups. And so that was my first cross-cultural experience with it. And again, totally volunteer, totally experimental, seat of the pants, not even sure what I was doing, but the learning was so rich and deep and the connection so rich and deep. So what I want to do tonight is integrate what I have learned over the past 12 years and put together from both being in the field as well as trying to read and learn from others along the way from all of my compatriots in the Healing Story Alliance, as well as other therapists who are trying to do this work. So I wanted to begin with a story that I heard on NPR. And David Isay is the founder of the StoryCorps Project, who I'm sure many of you have enjoyed. And if you haven't, to tune in to NPR on Friday mornings, I think it's at 7:30 and 9:30, they repeat a StoryCorps, that's Eastern Time, story. And David Isay was the brainchild behind that and has the author of also the book Listening is an Act of Love, as well as a book on the life on the Bowery, which where he went in and interviewed homeless men and recorded their stories. And in his interview on NPR, when asked about that work, he said that after he'd gone in and done all the interviews and captured the stories and put them into a book, he brought copies of the book back into the Bowery and was handing them out amongst the homeless men that they could see what he had done. And one of the men opened the book, thumbed through it quickly until he discovered that he indeed had a story in there. And he exulted, "Look, I exist." And for me, that moment of exultation of someone being witnessed in a way that the ripples come back and touch them and give themselves a sense of voice, empowerment, insight, to me is the heart of this work. And those moments when I'm sitting with people who suddenly realize that they do indeed not only exist, but their story is meaningful and can actually help others is, I think, part of the arc of healing in Healing Story. So I want to share a little bit about what I've actually learned from my daughter, who is only 21. Her name is Annie Arnzen, and she has been doing work in narrative healing and looking at also the arc of healing through trauma and overlapping it with the story arc and looking, comparing stages. And from that work, she's actually shared it with me, and I have since myself overlapped it with the hero's journey arc and have discovered that as in any time you get into deeper truths and you find that everyone is starting to say the same thing and it gets really exciting. So I want to share with you, if I can describe it without something in front of you, the overlay of healing through trauma, the story arc, the hero's journey arc, and what I've learned from that and how that informs the work that I do when going into work with people. So as in the classic story arc where there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and in the middle there are challenges and obstacles, and one moves hopefully through those with the help of others, with their own inner tools, and gets to a final end point where something's changed, where someone either sees themselves or the world from a different place, which I think about as a form of transformation that occurs. That's just a simple story arc. In the narrative healing through trauma arc, that beginning point is called the point of isolation and silence. And if you think of the work with people who are in pain in a story and coming from some sense of moving from a wounded story to a larger, deeper, more complex, more true story that can hold them, the first part is to help pull them out of a place where they are isolated with their story, where they're silent with the story, where they think they are all alone with their story. The second part, which is the middle of the story arc, in the healing story through trauma arc, the second stage is called agency and lament. And in this middle stage, one is that the task of this middle stage is remembering and forgetting, which I think is so beautiful in both the evolution of healing story as well as thinking about what happens in the course of a story. In this place, it's where one, once they emerge out of the isolation and silence stage and begin to share their story, begin to work it, to look at the parts that they are pulling up, that they are both remembering and then re/membering, reworking, reauthoring. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the reauthoring exercises I bring into my workshops as I'm helping people through this middle stage to walk around their story from multiple perspectives, to look at it through different character perspectives, different time perspectives, different mediums like fairy tale, so that they can begin to not only get comfortable in their story, but really play with it, work with it, understand it from a new place. So that third stage, which would be working towards the end or the transformation in the healing story, healing through narrative trauma, is the third stage is called advocacy and social organizing. It's the place where reintegration occurs. It's about not just reworking your story and ending there, but in fact using your new place in relationship to your story to be different in the world, to find agency, to find advocacy, to bring yourself forward in a different way because you are either empowered or clearer or stronger because you have moved through this story, are in a different place. If you put the hero's journey overlaying that same arc, and many of you may be familiar with the hero's journey where there's the what life was like before and then the call, which pulls a hero into that middle stage where everything gets turned upside down. Through, again, wise helpers or internal wisdom or other tools that come, one moves to a place of solving the riddles, of working through the challenges, of reaching the endpoint and transformation. But in the hero's journey, I like to think it's not just an arc, but a full circle. And the bottom half of the circle is actually going back to the beginning of the place where you began. You are no longer the same. You have undergone this journey and therefore have had a transformation, but your work isn't done until you return to where you were and bring your new learning and insight back to your original life that you might continue forward differently and, more importantly, help others as they start on their journey. So what is the end of your story is, in fact, impacting the beginning of another person's story. So as you hold this picture in mind, I want to talk a little bit about a young gentleman who came through my Public Voice Project in Roxbury, and I'm going to call him Ray. Ray actually came first as a spectator, as a listener, as a witness to a Public Voice final evening. We call them celebrations, but we don't call them anymore because that's an NSN word I understood. So our final performance night at the end of our workshops, where eight tellers had been working on their stories over the course of four evenings, each 3 hours long. So they had about 12 hours of story coaching, stood on the stage and shared stories of homelessness, of violence, gang violence, of mental illness, of their hero's journeys through these life obstacles and how they're holding themselves differently now and where they hope to go. Roy sat in this audience and was mesmerized. To describe Roy, he's about 20 years old, African-American, very slight, tall, dreadlocks, which he pulls into a fountain of hair at the top of his head. He is full of very intense nervous energy, and it was just that he couldn't even contain himself in his chair. at the end of all the tellings, we open it up to the audience. We have appreciations after every story, and at the very end, we do appreciations for the whole group. And Roy jumped to his feet, and he said, I got to do this. You got to tell me how I can do what you do, because I got a story that's killing me. And he meant that quite literally, and I got to get it out, and I need help. I just need help. So several of the tellers went up to him afterwards and talked about their experience and brought him over to me, and we signed him up immediately for the next round, which unfortunately wasn't scheduled to start for about 3 or 4 months. So by the time the next round started, I saw his name on the list and was delighted because I wasn't quite sure he was going to make it. And sure enough, the first evening he didn't show up. And so I tracked him down. I called him. He said, yeah. The sun came up. I couldn't be there. I'm going to be there this next week. And sure enough, the week two, he did walk into the room. And he walked in with another participant who had come the first week, and I didn't know they were connected. It was a woman in her 40s. And the connection between them is that the woman whose name, I'm going to call her Maria, her son was Roy's best friend, and both of them were involved in a gang. And her son, whose name was Andrew, had been killed in gang violence. And it had turned, obviously, Roy's world upside down, and he's trying to go straight, and she's doing her best to hold him in that place as if he were her son. And her whole goal was to get him to the Public Voice Project as a means to help him make peace with his story, as well as and the side consequence was he said he wouldn't do it unless she did, and for her to make peace with her story. The two of them came together for the next three sessions, and Roy continued to struggle with the story, but to continue to return to it over and over again. We were on the last evening, which is when we were doing our dress rehearsal, and one of the other tellers, and this is a side story, which I may get to be able to share more of that as well, but when she stood to tell her story in its final edition in front of the group, she ended up having an epileptic seizure and fell to the floor and was struggling quite almost violently in her seizure, and Roy was screaming at us to do something different than trying just to keep her safe. I was hesitant to call 911 because I knew that she was an illegal alien, and I was concerned for what would happen if she went to the hospital, and I was hoping that she'd pull out of the seizure and we could actually get more information from her, or even find out if she had medicine with her that we could help her with. But Ray burst from the room, called 911. The ambulance was there within minutes, but he was there on the street to guide them up and was lambasting them with obscenities all the way up the stairs, just reaming the two EMTs out. Primarily saying with great obscenities, and I'll leave those out for the sake of the recording, but where were you? Why did you wait so long? You don't care about anyone in Roxbury. You just assume we all died, on and on, to the point where the EMT trying to care for the woman on the floor said, I either had to shut him up or get him out, or they would call the police and have him arrested. So Ray did calm down. We sent our other participant in the ambulance off to the hospital. And we were pretty much at the end of our session. I pulled the group together in a circle. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about we had a ritual of coming into a circle, always at the beginning and at the end. So it was a safe place for us to gather this way with our arms around each other. Usually it was a way of entering our story group as well as calmly leaving it. But the good news is it was there as a tool for us. We pulled together so that our arms were essentially around Ray, who was trying to still bolt from the room in his upsetness. And it was then that Maria explained to us that on the night that her son died, he had been stabbed several times, and it was on the second floor of a private home where a party had been going on. Although the EMTs arrived very quickly because it was gang violence, they were not allowed to go up until a police escort arrived. and the police did not come for another 5 minutes. And in the interim period, Andrew died. So as far as Ray is concerned, no matter how long it takes, it's too slow. And his wounded story is whoever it is going to die. And it's partly my fault is the way he also sees it. Just in complete rage towards self, rage towards his world, his life, his community. In the circle, he said, essentially, he wasn't going to do it anymore. He was giving up. He was going back. He did not care about the story. He didn't care about us or the group. And the group really held him tightly. And if we go back again to the stages, he had been a guy who had started very much in silence and isolation, had found the safety in this group to pull out of that and to work to some agency where he was really struggling and working with his story and working it and reworking it and understanding audience and himself and story and the relationship between the three and what an audience could tolerate and not tolerate. And at this point, were he to quit now, what would happen is that he would slip back into that first stage of isolation and silence, and whatever healing work had started would most likely be lost. So my work and the work of the group was to hold him, to get him into that third stage of advocacy and reintegration, where he could hold on to himself and the power of his story and his audience in a way that he could tell his story, the audience could hear it, and rather than be scared or enraged at him, could be scared and enraged with him and be moved to action. And that became his new goal, how to contain himself enough that he could use his story as a powerful tool to work for change, as opposed to himself be rewounded or overwhelmed by his story to the point where he essentially would be lost again. And he saw his life at stake in that moment. He allowed the group to comfort him, to hold him, to get to that point where that rage was subtly transformed into an empowerment as opposed to a disillusionment. And he agreed he'd come the following week, which I figured I had about a 50-50 chance. But he did walk in that next week, and he took the floor, and he stole the room. He stole the show. It was one of the most powerful stories that have happened in my public voice workshops. So I wanted to illustrate that arc with Ray as the story. And now I'm going to take a little bit of extra time and just talk more quickly about how I enter those three stages and some of the things I do to push the participants through those stages, which one can look at as either the hero's journey or the narrative healing through trauma arc, or just the story arc from beginning, middle to end. And if I'm thinking about the story arc from beginning, middle to end, I'm also holding the beginning as I used to be, and the middle as but now I am. And the end is really the future story, and someday I hope to be. And I actually give that very arc of a model to participants to sit, to talk about how we're going to sort of dip back into the past, look how it's impacted the present, and how do we want to use what we now know about ourselves to change our story as we go forward into the future. So in that first stage of moving out of isolation and silence, the most important work of whether you're with an individual or a group is how to build both trust and engagement. And some of the tools that I use is the first thing we do when a group comes together is we create a safety contract and have people brainstorm about what do they need in order to feel safe within themselves, within each other, what are the guidelines for how they're going to hold each other, how they're going to bring themselves up. If there's a crisis or emergency, like we had with Ray that night, about staying in the room, about all emotions are allowed, but how do we hold each other in that, about non-judgment acceptance. For some of the work I have, some of the groups I've worked with, particularly in the shelters, they said that they've never had a contract like this. They've never actually felt safe in their world, and this is one of the most powerful parts of the whole workshop, was to know that that was possible and that they deserved that and could ask for that. and that that allowed them to bring themselves forward in a different way. I also integrate grounding each week, which is mindfulness exercises, which include opening meditation, guided visualizations. I interweave those through the groups as well, not only as a tool for people to calm and ground themselves to return to as an anchor, but it helps build their connection to a deeper presence that they really pull on at the end when they're at the time of telling their stories in public. So as we work in the 4 weeks through both finding, you know, discovering their stories, working in their stories, and then moving towards presentation and how are you going to hold that with others, this work with mindfulness and meditation and grounding serves as a growing skill and gift really to them. And again, for some people, they said they've never known that they had quiet inside. They'd never been able to access it before and how powerful that was for them. The other thing I do is I set up each workshop always the same. So it's almost ritualized. And from the work, again, that my daughter Annie had done in her own research, she was looking at indigenous cultures and the coming of age rituals and the importance of because the stages that they move through are very much the same as moving through trauma, interestingly enough, of pulling someone out of isolation, putting them into a middle where you actually take what's a solid story and undo it as a means of putting it back together in a different way. And then that third stage is re-entering where you were before, but new and changed. This is how all the indigenous cultures are actually doing healing story as a means of supporting their young to move into a different stage, both within the community, but within themselves as well. So the ritual I set up is actually just doing the same things each week in the same order, always starting with reviewing the safety contracts, doing a group check-in, beginning with a meditation, and then starting with a story starter. They know that they're always going to have a couple of exercises, but they're always going to do a final debrief at the end and then a closing meditation circle. So that following a ritual in itself is a very safe, containing kinds of thing. The other piece that's really important is when you're working with people who are bringing very wounded stories, who are coming because it is a healing story workshop, the tendency, and this often happens in therapy as well, is people come in and they immediately want to open to their most wounded place. And what happens is if they're not immediately flooded or scare themselves, is that they actually have the potential to just re-wound themselves. That stories are very much carried in our neural pathways, and the more we repeat a story, the deeper it gets. And the whole idea with healing story is, in fact, to develop other neural pathways that this story can adhere to and stretch into that keeps it from immediately diving into the wounded place. But in order to do that, you've got to also explore the other stories that one holds about themselves. So there's an exercise that I shared in the day-long workshop that we actually spent some time with, but I want to just quickly give you an overview of what it looks like so that you can understand what I mean by exploring sort of around it. This is an exercise that was developed by the narrative therapy people out in New Zealand who are creating narrative therapy interventions that are actually being used throughout the world, but they've done a lot of work in Africa, especially in the refugee camps. And this particular exercise was created and then really developed in Rwanda after the genocide there. And they call it the healing story tree. And if you can picture a tree in front of you, the place that you want to begin to pull stories are the roots. And the roots are the stories that ground us. They're the stories about where we came from, who are the people, the places, the memories, the songs that make us feel whole, make us feel full, make us feel alive, make us feel connected or grounded. and to pull those stories first, give somebody something to hang on to. And then you skip right up to the top of the tree to the leaves. And the leaves are the stories of the, if you think of the story arc of the end of where I'm going, it's someday I hope to be. It's the stories of my dreams, of what pulls me forward. What do I want my story to actually look like, feel like? What is the story I want to be telling in 5 years or 10 years about myself and who I am? So you have the grounding of the roots of the past and the pull towards the future so that somebody does know that there is so much more than just the wound of this story in the present. There's one other lovely aspect of the tree, which is represented by the metaphor of an apple, which is what are your very unique, specific gifts and tools and skills that are all yours, nobody else's, that make you not only uniquely you, but give you the ability to make that bridge between your roots and your leaves. And what are the stories about those things in action? When have you been at your best? When have you been connected to a passion and lived that? When have you done something for others that you felt really good or positive about yourself? And this very act of putting all these parts into the tree connects people to their strong story. Then you put that trunk in the middle that ties it all together, and somewhere on the trunk there are little knots where a branch has been knocked off or a wound has happened that has led a festering to occur. But what you can do is see that it is just a small part of a greater whole. When somebody walks in with a wounded story, often they think, this is me. I am this story. But when you hold this story, if you can, as just a small, one small story of a myriad of stories that have tremendous breadth and depth and complexity, it is so much easier to keep this story in perspective and to work on it from a safe place. So the tree exercise is one I often use. A timeline can do the same thing, where you look at what have been the defining moments of your life and you put the positive ones on top of the line, the more difficult ones below. You begin to sort of chart the patterns of your life, but you have both. You see that life is a series of highs and lows of multiple stories, and it puts that one story you choose to work in the perspective of how many years of life. So these are some of the early prompts I do to get stories rolling. And then I get people just comfortable telling these easy stories, these comfortable stories, these positive stories, so they get used to actually coming out of silence and sharing parts of themselves, but not about stuff that's difficult. And I save that until I get to the end of, and it's still very quick in these groups, to the end of week two and sometimes even the beginning of week three. I have other prompts that are simple, like many of you know these, the story of your name, or tell me about a day in your shoes, or one that I discovered was really helpful when I was working with the young prostitutes was they were so slow to connect or trust me. And in fact, just an aside, I set them up differently in that instead of doing 4 evenings, because I sensed that trust was going to be very difficult, I did 2-day-long Saturdays, both 8 hours. And we didn't actually start opening to telling stories till about 2 o'clock on the first day. And then when it opened huge. And the turnaround prompt was, and I was struggling. I was throwing prompts of all kinds, and they weren't even opening their mouths. They weren't even talking to each other. It was really painful, and I thought I was just going to resign and give up. But what turned it was I said, you know, I know nothing about your life. I can't even begin to understand it, and I know it's confusing why I'm even in this circle, in this room. But I know that each of you knows incredible things beyond your, most of them were between 15 and 18 years old, beyond your years, that you are old, old souls in young bodies for the many lives you've lived. And so I invited them to take out a piece of paper and just write down 10 things that they know are true. And they started to fill the paper. It was so powerful. And then I said, choose one of those, and if you're comfortable, tell us how you come to know that that's true. And we stayed beyond our 4 o'clock closing. And we were all in tears. It was so powerful. We came back the following Saturday, and it was as if they'd never seen me or known me, and we started over. And it wasn't again until about 2 o'clock after lunch that enough trust was built that we did part two of taking the stories they had begun to introduce and teasing them apart and working with them. What I realized was for that group, I still left them in that middle stage of reauthoring. We didn't get to the end. I needed at least two or three more Saturdays, full day long, for us to get probably close to that place. But that was part of my learning. So I've given you a little bit of insight about stage two already, which is the reauthoring and some of the examples of reworking by walking around stories from different perspectives and playing with stories. And all of these exercises, I usually start people in pairs, which is the safest place to begin, and then move to a triad, and then move to four people telling the story, and then we move up to the full group in eight. And I don't start listening to the stories until they've told them at least in a pair, a triad, a four, before I even hear them, because I know they feel safer with each other. And so before we bring me and my perspective in, it's week three when they're ready to have me be part of the circle. So the last stage, which is the integration and agency, is about bringing it forward, bringing it out into the world, letting them think about how can my story help another, teach another, empower another, impact somebody else to do something different? How can my standing in my own story change my life now and how I bring myself forward? What have I learned about myself through this process? What am I grateful for in having lived this story I lived and now being in a different place with it? How has this story made me stronger, clearer, deeper? And what I have found that very then process of being witnessed by another, not just in this group, but then out in public, is that final stage of the hero's journey of coming home and coming back. And for returning to my earlier story about Ray, that full circle of those tellers seeing the impact of their stories on this young man, Ray, that he was willing to then step into the same circle. And then Ray going through the whole course and making it to the end where the previous tellers came back to hear him, as well as he brought friends from his home group to hear him, encouraging them to take the next ground, is all that part of the stories being ripples that go out, that they not only strengthen and change you, but they can impact and change others, that then bring those ripples back to you again of seeing your own power, self-acceptance, compassion for self, compassion from others for you. It's just a very powerful process. So I know I've gone way over my time. I wanted to just give you this overview of the whole process so that you could ask some questions. And actually, I'll save this last part to the very end. I want to leave you with a poem, but let's open it up, take off mute and ask me some questions and or bring your experiences. I'd really love to hear what it's been like for any of you who've been doing this work as well.
Wow, that's all I can say, Lainey. It's just wonderful. Anybody on the call who'd love to have a question?
I have a question.
Sure.
And
hello. Identify yourself,
hi,
please.
This is KR.
KR, hello.
Hi, and wow, I just want to say I really, really appreciate having heard what you had to say. And my husband, Tony, has told me about it, and I just have so enjoyed, you know, learning more about it. And I really, I think that's part of IFS.
Yes.
It's the internal family system.
Yes.
And you know about that, I'm sure.
I do know about that. Do you want to share a little bit about what you know and how, from your perspective, it connects to this? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. And I've been involved with that. The first time was a couple months ago. There were five women, in the group, and we were doing IFS. And wow, it was great. It was a really wonderful experience to learn more about myself. And when you were talking about the women, the prostitutes, that you had the group together, and they had, you know, old souls, like they may have only been 15 or 16 or 17, but they'd already had so much stress and so many experiences. And that just kind of made me think, you know, I don't see any difference between that, you know, those girls being 15 and me being 56 and just having found out last year, you know, that I have a hard time understanding how my mom was and her control of me, you know. And I just started thinking about that, and I'm 56, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because I'm deaf and I have difficulties communicating. I think I had a different experience than some hearing people would have had. I have a different level of access to communication. And, you know, and sometimes that causes a lot of drama. I've had a lot of, you know, traumatic experiences that I think have blocked things for me. Mm-hmm. But I think, I guess I was just really, it really hit me, and I had to go like, wow, you know, that's something I really related to, having a difficult time communicating and building trust with people like that. So thank you so much for sharing that, and just thank you for the tree analogy as well.
Isn't that beautiful? Thank you, Pierre. I want to just expand a little bit on what KR said, and for those of you who aren't familiar with internal family systems or IFS, it's a therapeutic approach which was started by Richard Schwartz. And the perspective is that he was doing family systems work outside, but then started to realize that we all have multiple voices inside. And he made a shift to actually listening to the multiply different stories that represent what he calls parts inside of us and the relationship between those stories. And listening to them really opens the deeper and deeper understandings of those stories and the role they play essentially in caring for and protecting a very vulnerable self, which is underneath all of those stories. And I believe that it connects very closely to what I'm talking about of building trust is by hearing some of the easier stories to tell. And when one feels safe in telling those and listens to at that level, it allows one to then go into a deeper level underneath and let some of those more difficult stories feel safe enough to rise and be heard. And if those are heard and held, it actually opens the doorway to eventually down to a self, which is underneath and is a very precious place to connect to. So a little IFS 101.
Other questions or comments? Lady, I have one. Just in the recent discussion you have, following up KR's point, you know, I admire you because you're so facile with your profession, psychology. If you're not a psychologist, how comfortable should we feel in trying to develop some of these approaches with groups that we may be called to lead or inspired to lead? What more should we learn in before we try it? I guess that's another way of asking the question.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've sort of learned the hard way is that I think it's really helpful to have two people in the room. That I had the experience with Roy when the other participant ended up going to the hospital. That was a night I really could have used a co-leader, and it was probably irresponsible for me to do this work without one. So I think that to partner with people who do have some therapeutic experience can really be helpful. And a lot of people who have therapeutic experience don't really understand story. And to bring those two things together is a real powerful duality. But I think people often underestimate the power of story and what happens when people are connecting to their difficult or their wounded stories.
I often compare it to swimming in the ocean, and that we may be good swimmers, and we're used to sort of being close to shore and out on a good day, but if we're in unfamiliar waters, we can get over our heads really quickly, especially if there's an undertow or a rip current that we're not aware of, and it's really easy to be in distress. So that's where it can be so helpful to have a co-leader who can either be a second pair of eyes or can help pause and do more of a therapeutic intervention if even one member in the room gets overwhelmed and just needs to be contained in a way that doesn't take the others into a difficult place. So I've been, of course, talking about working with some very difficult populations, and I think a good place to start if one's interested in doing this work is perhaps a little lighter than with prostitutes or recently released prisoners. So there's easier ways to begin. And so it might be worth, before you jump into the deep end of the pool, to do some shallow end swimming and get a feel for it. That would be, I think, the best way to start.
Lonnie, what are some, this is Rona, what are some books you would recommend that we might be able to read?
It's prolific now. There are so many that are out there. But the first one that I read, and I come back to it often, is Richard Stone's The Healing Power of Story. The Healing Power of Story. I think that's what it's called. Richard Stone. He's got a lot of the exercises I just continue to return to and use over and over again. I've really enjoyed all of Luis Mel Madrona's books. He's written a lot about one's called Story Medicine. He's a Native American psychiatrist who does a lot of story work and ritual work. And he just got an interesting perspective on story and how it can be used. So I've learned a lot from him as well. But I have a bibliography I'd be happy to post on the listserv if that would be helpful to people.
That would be great to see.
You know, Lenny, one of the things that might be helpful, if you don't mind, is that the three pictures or graphs that you have that you were describing, and you do a great job of describing the pictures, but they would be helpful for people, particularly for people who want to have somebody listen to this presentation and have those in their hands.
That would be great. I'd be happy to share that, and I can send it to you or to Allison to figure out how to post on the site, because I'd have no idea how to begin to do that, but
okay.
I'm happy to send it along.
Send it to both of us, and we'll get it to Karen, but I think they'll be helpful to the spread of the knowledge, as well a couple of succinct references. Other questions or comments from folks? We've got a little bit of time.
Lanny, this is Tony. Curious. I had some friends of mine that were the ICU nurses, and it was a couple. And when somebody died, they found at first when they would go home that they would have arguments because they cared so much about the people. When you're working with these populations and you care deeply about them, how do you keep yourself balanced through the whole thing?
That's lovely. I am so in awe and moved by the people who I work with and their courage, not just to tell their stories, but to live their lives. I find that I'm not drained, but I'm totally exhilarated by this work, and the insights I get into the human capacity, not only for facing our dilemmas, but for continually, resiliently coming back and re-entering our worlds over and over again. One of the stories that I want to end with, and it sort of ties into this a little bit, is this happened with the young women prostitutes. When we entered the room that morning, we were such strangers, and they felt such animosity towards me. They were willingly part of a larger program that they were attending, and they were They've got residential care as well as therapy and mentoring, and they were all working on their GEDs and trying to stay off the street. But part of the program was that they were required to take this story workshop, and they were really resentful that they had to do it. So by the end of that day, after they were telling their stories to each other, and I ended the day by telling a story about some of the work that I had done, both in an organization where I was working with upper-level executives doing story work, and the same day I was working with recently released prisoners, and I'd given the two groups the same prompt, and what came out of it was a very similar story that an executive told that a prisoner told. And it was that day was just this huge aha for me of people are people are people. And I took the risk of sharing that story with these young women. And in that moment, they opened and they said, I bet you have some stories that aren't just like ours, but in other ways probably are just like ours. And I said, I do. At which point, you know, the room just opened in a whole different way of everyone letting each other and me really in. That is just such a privilege and a grounding in my own humanity as I sit with them. But I have a poem that I had with me that I read at the end of that day. It's a powerful one for me, and I keep understanding it on deeper and deeper levels. But it's called Namaste. But it's a few simple lines that say, I honor the place within you where the entire world resides. I honor the place within you of hope, of light, of truth, of peace. I honor the place within you where when you are in that place within you, and I am in that place within me, there is only one of us. And that for me sort of sums up what this work is. When you are working on that deep level of story work, we're all telling the same story, and we're all trying to heal that broken story and find some wholeness that can carry us forward. And when we have the strength and courage to come out of our silence and engage that story with others as witnesses to that, to get it to a point where we even feel courageous enough to have that same story carry us back to the beginning that we might then help others, that to me is the healing story, journey, and circle. And we're all on it, no matter what our story is.
I have to say wow again, Lainey. I just a very powerful poem. And I would ask you, if you've, I mean, about three times during your presentation, I kept on saying, she really ought to publish this. She really ought to publish this. Because I think just your last turn of phrase is so helpful for a lot of what we're trying to do. So I know you've got a lot of irons in the fire, but boy, you've distilled a lot of material into some very helpful drops, I think.
Thank you, Joe. Well, that's an iron I want to put in the fire, so this is good encouragement for me to keep going. I appreciate that.
And in terms of, we're coming up on, anybody got another question or comment, although the poem was really like benediction time.
Yeah.
Anybody?
I do.
Okay.
Coriana.
Hi, Coriana.
Hi there. I'm so grateful for your call. It's really, for this whole presentation, it's been really informative. But I was wondering if you've worked with people whose stories are still on a subconscious level, and how do you start working with them to help bring it to a conscious level where you can do all the work you just talked about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think when someone feels safe and ready, that's when the story comes, and it's not a river you can push.
Mm.
And so sometimes people will come with a seed of they have an inkling of what the story is. And that's when you can do some sort of guided imagery and visualization to see if they're ready to open to it. But oftentimes, when they're ready, you can't not tell it, and it will come. But I've often found when I just give it a fairly general prompt, then people have the control of how much or how little they want to bring. And if a story is ready, almost no matter what prompt you give, that story is going to come. It's really funny how that happens. But people do the work they're ready to do, and you've got to respect where they are in their process. I also give people a lot of room to pull back and to not tell a story. And, in fact, to just go back and tell you one quick aspect of the story of the woman who had the seizure. She realized that she wasn't ready to tell the story that she thought she was. And she had come to this workshop in order to work with it and tell it. And so I really encouraged her to, I said, you have three choices. One is we can do some deeper work and get you to a place where you can tell the story. The second choice is you can share some small aspect of this story that you do feel comfortable with. Or the third is just put it away, find another story that you do feel ready and comfortable to tell, and let's just work with that. And she said, I'm going to go with that last option. I'm not ready to touch that other one. When she stood up to tell her new story, all she could think about was the story she wasn't telling, and she had a seizure. And I met with her the next day to just check that she was okay and to process it. And I said, have you ever had a seizure before? And she said, just one other time. It was when I was in therapy and trying not to tell the story that I can't tell. So our brain is very, very powerful. And it will find a way for us to keep ourselves safe, I think, even if it takes a physical toll on us. So I have such respect for trusting people and where they are in their process. And if at any point they give me the signals that it's too much too fast, I have quick exits for them to get out. It's for all of our sakes. So I don't know, Carianne, if that's sort of helpful, but I think if one's ready, you can't keep it from coming. And if it's not ready, don't push it.
It is very helpful. Thank you.